From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, practicing medicine under fire, we meet one of the world's most respected war surgeons, Dr. Chris Yanu. He was chief of surgery in Somalia with the International Committee for the Red Cross. Before that, he was the only surgeon in a Palestinian refugee camp, which was under constant siege. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new reissues by three singers, Ella Fitzgerald, Blossom Dearie, and Helen Merrill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States and Russia, co-sponsors of the stalled Mideast peace talks, are inviting Arab, Israeli, and Palestinian negotiators to return to the table in April, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Just yesterday, Secretary of State Warren Christopher ended his visit to the Mideast, saying he'd been unable to set a date for the next round of talks. Palestinian leaders had apparently ruled out further negotiations until Israel does more to repatriate 400 Palestinian deportees stranded in South Lebanon. But there were further consultations with the Palestinians last night and this morning, and today Christopher said he and Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev felt confident enough about the situation for the next round to commence in April. Christopher spoke after meeting Kozarev in Geneva. With a time now set and a place, Washington, D.C., and with Syrian, Jordanian, and Lebanese leaders indicating their desire to resume the talks, the Palestinian delegation is under tremendous pressure to participate as well. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Clinton suggested today that he may call for higher taxes on tobacco and other products to help pay for his national health insurance plan. The so-called sin taxes would go toward the cost of extending health insurance to the 37 million Americans who don't have it. The president said that a lot of the money spent on private health insurance and government tax payments goes to deal with health problems caused by bad health habits like smoking. White House officials said the White House Task Force on Health Care Reform is also considering a proposal to tax workers' health benefits as income, although that proposal is seen as less likely to win approval. The campaign to become the next Prime Minister of Canada has begun now that Brian Mulroney has announced he's resigning as leader of the country's ruling Conservative Party. Jennifer Ludden reports that the leading candidates are all members of the current cabinet.
Topping the list of contenders are Trade Minister Michael Wilson, the point man for Canada's aggressive pursuit of free trade, and Kim Campbell, formerly head of the Justice Department and now Defense Minister. She would become the first woman to lead the Conservatives and could provide the appearance of change Mulroney says is needed to renew the party. Another female candidate is Barbara McDougall, who's had a visible profile as Minister of External Affairs. Several other insiders are considered possible successors. None, it appears, would drastically alter Canada's moderately conservative public policy. The new leader will likely be chosen in June and will have the task of raising the party from a distant second in the polls to defeat the now leading Liberals when national elections are held this fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden in Montreal.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points today to close at 3,365. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. The New Jersey General Assembly voted today to override Governor Jim Florio's veto of a bill that would weaken the state ban on semi-automatic weapons. The measure in question would repeal the ban for all affected weapons except Uzis and AK-47s. It would undo a 1990 state law that bans the sale or possession of semi-automatic firearms capable of holding more than 15 rounds. Florio, a Democrat, blamed the General Assembly's Republican leadership for the repeal and called the vote a sneak attack on sanity. The override attempt now goes to the state Senate. A major winter storm is moving over parts of the Midwest this evening, dumping up to 10 inches of snow in some areas. Chad Perkram of member station WMUB reports.
It's the heaviest snow of the season in southwest Ohio tonight. Some areas already receiving up to 2 inches, with the snow falling at the rate of at least 1 inch per hour. Winds are gusting up to 25 miles an hour, drifting snow across roadways. Some drifts are reportedly as high as a foot. Eric Pitlack is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Cincinnati.
If we get 7 with this storm, there is no chance of it changing over to rain, which means that any snow that does fall is going to stick and will not melt, at least tonight. So road conditions are going to remain very hazardous right on through the night.
Road crews are out plowing and salting main arteries. However, secondary roads have already become hazardous. For National Public Radio, I'm Chad Pergram in Oxford, Ohio.
A jury in Florida has found 3 young men guilty of armed carjacking under a new federal carjacking law. The conviction means that the men now face mandatory life sentences in federal prison for committing an armed carjacking involving violence. The men still face trial in state court on charges of murder and attempted murder. The federal law was passed by Congress last year after a series of highly publicized carjacking cases around the country. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Chris Yanu, performed surgery far away from the sterilized hospital rooms he was trained in. Dr. Yanu is among the world's most respected war surgeons. He's repaired gruesome war wounds in makeshift hospitals while under fire. He spent most of 1992 in Somalia directing surgical operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross. From 1985 to 87, he was the only surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila in Beirut. He recently wrote a book about his experiences there called Besieged. Dr. Yanu grew up in Toronto, the son of Greek Macedonian immigrants. He's lived in third world countries for over 20 years. I asked him why he went to Somalia.
Well, I was there with the International Committee of the Red Cross as a surgeon, and the ICRC over the last couple of years had had some very bad experiences in Somalia. 4 surgical teams had to be repatriated, in effect evacuated from the country because of security concerns. And they asked me to go there to coordinate their surgical activities and to set up a flying surgical team. And this we managed to do over the last year.
You're pretty fearless when it comes to this.
No, I do feel fear. I've been shot at, my hospitals have been bombed over the years, and I would be quite stupid if I did not feel fear. I've simply managed to be able to master my fear and be able to continue to function as a surgeon under those circumstances.
What was the state of surgical facilities in Somalia when you got there?
Very disparate, in that there is really no longer a Somalia. There are 10 Somalias or Somalilands, and the country has really been divided up into a series of regions, each one being the traditional fiefdom of a different clan or subclan. And according to the region, there is a tremendous difference in surgical facilities. Some places, you have a hospital, district hospital, that is fully equipped, electric generators. There's relatively good qualified staff available. Other areas, the hospital has been looted. There are no windows, no doors. The roof is gone, let alone the surgical equipment and supplies. Yet other areas, the hospital's been totally destroyed. And then in yet other, especially along the Kenyan border, there are hospitals which are really bush hospitals, thatched huts.
What were some of the changes that you tried to make immediately upon getting to Somalia?
Well, the first thing was Mogadishu, and it was just before the ceasefire last end of February, I believe, beginning of March, 1992. By a coincidence of geography, all of the hospitals in Mogadishu were in the south part of the city. And in the north, a group of doctors and nurses under the aegis of the Somali Red Crescent Society, which, of course, is the local counterpart, the national society for the International Red Cross, had grouped together and set up a field hospital in a villa and transformed the living room into an operating theater. And then the post-operative patients were put into a series of nearby villas. And by the end of things, there were 27 villas with 4,592 patients. It looked more like a slaughterhouse. The ICRC helped the Somali Red Crescent to then transform a prison, which was located 2.5 kilometers, about a mile and a half outside of the city, into a hospital. And I was asked to help set up that hospital, and we got it going with our Somali colleagues from the Red Crescent Society. And that was the very first thing, and we made that hospital function. And then I traveled about the country, visiting different areas, helping to rehabilitate hospitals, renovate them, set up the systems of functioning that one usually find in a hospital, sterilization, packaging of instruments, post-operative care, etc., operating and helping train my Somali colleagues in war surgery how war surgery differs from civilian surgery.
How does war surgery differ from civilian surgery?
A war wound, by definition, is dirty and contaminated. And therefore, what you do with it is wound excision, a debridement. You have to cut out all of the devitalized tissue, all of the muscle that has been damaged. If you leave it in, there's a danger of infection, even gangrene. So you cut it all out, and you leave the wound open. You don't close the skin. You put on a dressing, which you leave untouched for 4 or 5 days. On the fifth day, you open it up under anesthesia. The wound should be clean if you've done a good debridement. And it's at that point and that point only that you close the skin. If you close it immediately on the first day, you have a very, very high risk of infection and with an abscess formation or septicemia. And that is the big danger in war wounds, that and tetanus as well as gangrene. And of course, these are populations, by and large, who have not been actively immunized against tetanus. And I saw quite a number of cases of tetanus in Somalia. The treatment is very difficult, especially with the rudimentary technology available. And quite a number of patients were dying because of the tetanus.
Oh, I imagine, you know, if you have a war wound and you're living in war circumstances, it's hard to keep the dressing clean. I mean, you might not even be able to stay in the hospital. There might not be a bed for you to stay in.
Well, the important point is this. The natural physiological resistance of the person. Too many doctors, especially surgeons, my colleagues, tend to think that they heal their patients. We don't. We help the human body to heal itself. That's very important. Too many doctors play at God. There is the natural resistance. I mean, we've had wars now for tens of thousands of years, and there have been wounded all throughout recorded and unrecorded history. There were no doctors, and yet not every wounded patient died or suffered a complication. So there is the natural defense of the organism, and what we try to do is help the organism really to heal itself. You cut out the devitalized tissues. Even under very difficult conditions of hygiene, you would be surprised how few wounds get infected if your surgery is correct.
How do you design a hospital to be safe in an area that's under attack? And maybe you can compare the safety precautions you took in Somalia with those that you took in West Beirut.
Totally different, actually. You have to know your ballistics. In order to perform surgery in a war zone, you have to learn a little bit about electricity, plumbing, as well as ballistics. What sort of weapons are being used, and therefore what sort of eventual danger are you really submitted to? If there's heavy artillery or mortars, then what you try to do is set up a hospital so that at least the operating theater and as much of the hospital as possible is underground. Now, in a bomb shelter, in an underground garage, whatever. And then other things you do is you reinforce the walls and the ceiling with sandbags. And depending on, again, the sort of weapons being used, that will determine the thickness of the protection of sandbags. In Beirut, when I was in the refugee camp of Shatila, the constructions were all cinder block, fairly flimsy. And we knew fairly well what type of heavy arms and mortars would be used against the refugee camp and the hospital, which was right in the center of it. And we put a roof over part of the hospital of reinforced concrete, 10, 12 centimeters thick, then a layer of rubber tires. And you cover that with sheeting and then the sandbags. The rubber tires dissipate the pressure of the explosion when a shell lands on it. The sandbags take the shrapnel, the fragments, during the explosion of the shell. And in that way, you can also help to protect the facilities that are inside.
What were sanitary conditions like in the various operating rooms that you came across in Somalia?
Well, at times it was an ordinary house. I mean, if the hospital itself had been destroyed, it was an ordinary house that we would take over with the agreement of the community, the elders, the medical staff. And just a question of washing down the floor with soap and water, pulling in the kitchen table and then operating. The windows, of course, are open, and you spend more time chasing the flies than anything else.
Well, let me stop you there. Isn't that pretty dangerous if a fly lands on an incision?
Well, again, the wound, war wounds are dirty and contaminated by definition. And, of course, but there are no windows, there's nothing else to do. And you don't get infections by simply having a fly, you know, drop on a wound. Also, in certain parts of the world, in South Asia, maggots are purposely introduced into infected wounds.
Why?
Because a maggot will only eat necrotic tissue, dead tissue, and performs a very good debridement in effect, a wound excision. Now, it might not be very comfortable psychologically for the individual, but after a couple of weeks of having maggots in a wound, the wound is quite clean, actually.
Have you tried that as a procedure?
I've not tried it myself. I've read about it on a couple of occasions, and I have seen incidences where that has occurred without it being willed. That wounds have been infestated with maggots and so forth. And when you open them, if that process has been going on long enough, you find that it's quite clean. And once it is clean, the maggots leave. They do not eat live tissue, only dead tissue. So when there's no more food left for them, they fall out of the wound, actually. But you can operate under those conditions, and we had no problems. And with fresh wounds, as you say, wounds that are less than 6 hours old, and, well, I performed perhaps about 1,000 operations in Somalia over the year and supervised another 1,500 of my Somali colleagues. Of the vast majority were fresh wounds, I would say. Of those fresh wounds, we had an infection rate of only 1 or 2%.
Well, that's really low considering the circumstances you were operating under.
Again, one of the big problems in the West, in North America, with infections in hospitals is that hospitals are hermetically sealed structures. And you cultivate a bacterial flora in the hospital that takes out all of the bacterial strains that are sensitive to antibiotics. And what you have left in the hospital is bacteria that are resistant to all antibiotics. And that's the big problem with bacterial infections in North American hospitals, that it's normally a bacteria that would not cause an infection, but because the rest of the bacterial flora are no longer there, you select out these strains that are resistant to just about every antibiotic known. In the third world, hospitals have open doors and windows, and there is a continuous change of the bacterial flora in the hospital, and therefore no selection of bacterial strains. And you never get these raging epidemics due to Pseudomonas that you find in North American hospitals.
Have you operated a lot without anesthetics?
No. I've always had anesthetics available. The point is that it's a very, very different type of anesthesia that one is accustomed to in the West. We use no gas in our operations. We use an anesthesia that is given by injection. And it's called ketamine, and you can give it by intramuscular or intravenous or even by a drip, and you have to add some diazepam, Valium, and an analgesic with it, and it gives excellent anesthesia with very, very few side effects, and then you can add to it muscle relaxants, intubate your patient, perform all sorts of operations, no problem, and you can carry enough of this around in a suitcase to perform several hundred major operations. That plus local anesthesia, and you can do all sorts of things with local anesthesia. So it's really a question of adapting to those conditions. In a war zone, you don't want sophisticated material, gas anesthesia. I mean, every cylinder of oxygen that you use with the gas anesthesia is a potential bomb. If your cylinder of oxygen is hit by a shrapnel and it blows up, then you've blown up your whole hospital and everybody along with it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, who has been a war surgeon for about 12 years. He was chief of surgery for the Red Cross in Somalia from February of last year through January of this year. And he's also written a book called Besieged about his work from 85 to 87 as the only surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp Shatila in West Beirut. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
War surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu is my guest. You must have a lot of experience talking to young, arrogant men with guns. What are some of the techniques you've learned over the years, how to talk yourself out of situations where someone is holding a gun on you?
It depends on how well I know the young men. I've been in very, very different situations where I've been, I was known, I was not known. And obviously when they know you, then it's a totally different situation. And somebody's sitting there with a gun shooting and he's angry and so forth. And you tell them, look, you want to shoot? Shoot me. And of course the fellow is shocked. And then you start dealing with him on that basis. Now, if the fellow doesn't know you, you don't tell him you want to shoot somebody, shoot me. That's not the way to handle that situation. I think the important thing to realize is that war is one thing, that when you are shooting, even from a distance, that there's a certain that there's a psychological distanciation as well. Whereas when you are face to face with someone, and this young, angry man who perhaps has just lost a friend or a close member of the family and is really torn apart. I mean, it is that person who is weak and they simply happen to have a gun. And at that point, what you try is not to be provocative, but to empathize and try to work on a basis that you show yourself not to be a danger to that person.
Can you give us an example of a situation like that?
Well, there was one that I speak about in the book. I was director of the hospital in Shatila, and I had one fellow who wanted to marry one of the patients in the hospital. It was a woman who had been injured, and I had operated on her a couple of times. And her mother, brother, agreed. So he's visiting his fiancée in the hospital. The uncle disagreed. The uncle did not want the marriage. So they had a couple of arguments, knives shooting at each other and so forth. They ran out into the alleyways of Shatila. Each went to get his Kalashnikov. The young fellow comes back looking for the uncle to shoot him. And I stop in front of him and he fires a shot over my head. And I tell this fellow, Sherbal, you want to shoot? Then shoot me. And his eyes just went blank. And he said, what the hell am I doing here? And then he came to himself again. He turned around and ran off. He comes back a few minutes later, and that first time was with a revolver. Now he comes back with his AK-47. Hmm. I stop him again, and a couple of fellows come to help me, and I talk him down, and they get his gun away from him. But again he runs off, and he still has his revolver. And while he runs past an alleyway, he and the uncle spy each other, and he shoots with his revolver, and the uncle replies with a whole magazine from his Kalashnikov. And that's 30 bullets. There were 2 dead and 15 wounded.
Wow.
Now, that's the sort of situation that you get when you're living under siege in Shatila, which is only 200 yards by 200 yards, and after 6 months of shelling and bombing, etc., there are only 100 yards by 100 yards left. And look, if you treat people like animals, they're going to react like animals. Well, so that's simple. And in those under that pressure of existence, fine, somebody cracks.
Well, you're the surgeon in that situation, so you have to take care of all the wounded after the shooting's done.
Yes. And then when the community sets up a sort of tribunal and says the uncle is at fault and he is the one who was shot and this is not allowed, and in any case, whether his niece marries this fellow or not, once the mother and brother have agreed, it's none of his business. So the tribunal, in the name of the community, decides to execute him. Now, as a matter of principle, I am against capital punishment. But this is a very specific context. This is 3,500 people down to 1,500 people that are living in 100 yards by 100 yards. And if you allow that sort of vendetta, etc., to happen, then you're actually headed towards collective suicide. So this fellow is executed, and I am supposed to make the statement of death. examine the cadaver and pronounce death. That's the sort of situation that can become very, very complicated.
So you were asked to do that and you did it?
Yes. He was. They shot him in the head and I came in and examined the cadaver and went out and said, yes, the fellow was dead and so forth, and signed the papers necessary.
You, when you were in Shatila, the refugee camp was under siege for, I think, 134 consecutive days at one point?
That was one battle. I mean, it was under siege for about 2.5 years. And during that time, there were a series of battles, one of which lasted, you know, 5-6 months. And during the battle, nothing gets in, nothing gets out. It's totally sealed off.
I'm sure one thing that came into the hospital was a lot of danger, you know, seriously injured people. How do you perform triage in during a battle that lasts 134 days when you're the only surgeon in the camp?
Well, I was not the only doctor, and I had a half dozen Palestinian and Lebanese colleagues with me. And I, over the various battles that occurred before that, I trained them in the basics of war surgery. Some surgical gestures that they could perform themselves, putting in a chest tube, debridements of minor wounds and so forth. So I did the major surgery. Now, triage is triage. And you have your rules. You have a category of patients. The first are those that need surgery, urgent surgery, and where can you can expect very good results. And then you have patients who need surgery, but who can wait for surgery without really suffering any consequences. You have mildly injured patients, and then you have those that would require so much time and so much effort that you would put into risk the lives of some of the others. Fine, so you make out your categories and you begin. It's one of the most difficult decisions to make in medical practice. You do it.
Does anybody ever hold a gun to you and say, treat my son or treat my mother, or else I'll kill you?
That's happened.
What did you say?
It's all part of triage. At that point, that's your category number one. It would be stupid to negotiate under those circumstances. And I have performed surgery with the barrel of a gun stuck between my ribs, and you do it. And then afterwards, of course, the fellow comes back and he's apologetic and this and, you know, please forgive me and so forth. Terrific, you're going on to your second patient. But at that point, your triage says that that's number one, and you do it. And once you get it finished, then you can get on with the rest of your work.
Did you find that having a gun pointed at you affected your performance?
No, I have good powers of concentration. And usually in those cases, in effect, the patient is not that seriously injured. And so your operation takes very, very little time, and you get it done quickly, and it's not a difficult operation.
Dr. Cristiano has written a book about his work as a war surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp Shatila in Beirut. The book is called Besieged. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Dr. Yana will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Chris Janu says medicine for him is not an occupation, it's a calling. And he's been called to practice in some of the most devastated and war-torn parts of the world. Coming up, we continue our interview with Dr. Janu. He recently returned from Somalia, where he directed the surgical operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new reissues featuring Helen Merrill, Blossom Deary, and Ella Fitzgerald. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin will meet April 4th in a third country, which has yet to be determined. This one-day summit is designed to bolster the Russian leader at a critical time. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher said the United States is determined to support the cause of reform in Russia. It's hoped this summit will strengthen Yeltsin, who's challenged by political opponents who want to slow his reform program. Just what President Clinton will be able to offer Yeltsin beyond the $413 million budgeted for this year is unclear. The administration would like to increase this aid, but Congress is far from enthusiastic about new spending. And until the Russian government can get rampant inflation under control, the International Monetary Fund is unlikely to come up with new loans. Yeltsin is under pressure to adopt a foreign policy more independent of the U.S., more sympathetic to former Soviet allies like Serbia and Iraq. The challenge for the Clinton administration is to persuade Russians it's in their interest to work with the West. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Also in Washington, President Clinton announced today that airdrops of food and medicine will be made to eastern Bosnia. The White House says no combat airplanes will be used in this operation, and aid will be directed at areas where land convoys have been unable to reach because of continued heavy fighting. The airlift is termed a temporary measure, and the president said continued fighting in Bosnia has taken a staggering toll. Mr. Clinton said today the need for help is greatest in eastern Bosnia and that U.S. airdrops will be made without regard to ethnic affiliation. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin was released from the hospital today and immediately got back to work. He had been hospitalized for 4 days due to a heart problem aggravated by a typhoid shot that he received last week. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
At about midday, Aspin waved to reporters as he left Georgetown Hospital in Washington. He went to the Pentagon and then to Capitol Hill to present the administration's plan to airdrop food and medicine in Bosnia. Aspin told reporters that he is fully recovered. His doctors echoed that view, but they also said they are recommending that Aspin use a pacemaker. The device, about the size of a silver dollar, would be implanted under his collarbone and would modify the contractions of his heart. They said Aspin would feel tired for another week or so and suggested that he give up playing squash. Although Aspin is expected to be fully able to do his job, the administration has moved to speed up the confirmation of the number two man at the Pentagon, William Perry. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,365.14 on volume of more than 253 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. President Clinton indicated today his support for a higher tax on cigarettes to help pay for health care reforms. White House aides say that higher taxes on other tobacco products and on alcohol are also under consideration. One administration estimate has put the cost of providing health care insurance for those who don't have it at between $30 and $90 billion a year. According to estimates by the Congressional Budget Office, doubling federal taxes on cigarettes and alcohol would come to about $41 billion in 5 years. Gun control advocates are claiming victory in Virginia. The state legislature has passed a bill banning handgun purchases to one a month, although there are some exceptions to that rule. Laura Canoy reports.
The bill says if you want to buy more than one handgun a month, you must register with state police. You have to give identification, proof of residency, and fill out a form saying how many guns you want to purchase and why. Virginia Governor Doug Wilder fought hard for the bill, citing Virginia's reputation as a major source of crime guns along the East Coast. Wilder says the tough certification process will stop gun traffickers from shopping in Virginia.
We're going to have a study on it as soon as the bill becomes effective July 1st as to how many persons come and do that. I'll bet you you'll find a small number to do it.
The National Rifle Association launched a major campaign against the bill. The NRA argued that criminals get their weapons from the black market, so restrictions on legal purchases won't stop them from getting guns. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy reporting.
Ground staff for Air France held a one-day strike today at the Frankfurt International Airport. According to local news reports, it's the first in a series of 24-hour walkouts in Germany in support of calls for new salary contracts for employees at Air France. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Chris Yanu. He's been a war surgeon for more than a decade. For 2 years, he was the only surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila in Beirut. Last year, he directed surgical operations in Somalia for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He's also served in Cambodia. I asked him what it's like to go from one war to another.
One sees that, I mean, history does not repeat itself. It's just that human beings are capable of repeating the stupidities and errors of history. That's what happens, and you see it time and time again.
But I'd imagine you just get disgusted, though. I mean, going from one place to another where you see people killing people of their own country, of their own neighborhood, and one war ends
you,
and you go to another war that's
just
beginning.
It shows you quite a number of things, that wars, some wars are ideological, others are not. You don't even need ethnic, religious, racial, or ideological differences to have a civil war. I mean, Somalia is a homogeneous country. 99% of the people are ethnic Somalis, same language, same religion, same traditions and culture, etc., etc. But it's divided along family lineages. So you can even have a civil war in a homogeneous society. In other situations, other forces come into play, yes. There's a great deal of cynicism involved, but there's a line from a Woody Allen film: no matter how cynical you get, you can never catch up.
You were in Somalia from February of 92 to January of 93, so you got there before the eyes of the world were as focused on that country as they later were. What was it like for you as the troops and the press converged on Somalia?
Well, we had very mixed feelings because for months, of course, we saw the famine developing in front of us. The ICRC put out an urgent appeal in December of 1991 saying that mass starvation was imminent in Somalia. No reply. Same message in March. Nothing. Whenever we found a journalist running around Nairobi, we grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and say, come please see Somalia. Nothing. And then all of a sudden, in August or September, I think Jane Perlez, who had been there, was writing and so forth, finally got her article on page one of the New York Times. And that's when it opened. Also, and you had Boutros Ghali saying, I wish the Security Council would pay a little bit more attention to the poor man's war in Somalia and not so much the rich man's war in Yugoslavia. What he meant, of course, was the white man's war and the black man's civil war. And one of the reasons that Somalia was neglected for so long was for basically that, basically racist reasons. It was not as important because this is another African horror story.
How was your work as a doctor changed when the military and the press showed up in Somalia?
As I said, we had mixed feelings. My work changed largely because with media attention, many non-governmental organizations started to come into the country. Somalia was a very lonely place for a long, long time. Apart from the International Red Cross, there were three or four NGOs in Mogadishu and one or two others in Kisimayo, and that was it. In the rest of the country, there was nobody except Red Cross and Somali Red Crescent. And when the press made the story of Somalia sexy, the NGOs come in. And all of a sudden, everybody's tripping over each other's feet, trying to set up therapeutic feeding centers and so forth, and running around getting UNICEF funding for their little project. Terrific. When they move into a hospital, we move out. And we concentrate on the regions where there are no other non-governmental organizations. And because the sexy regions of Somalia were Baidoa and Bardera, because that's where the starvation was, that's where everybody went. There are other places in the country that need help. There's no starvation, but the situation is fragile. It's still stable. If more NGOs were to become involved there, they would help reinforce the stability of those regions and prevent them from falling into the same sort of chaos and starvation that exists elsewhere. But it's not sexy. There are no journalists there to come in and photograph your projects so that you can then do your fundraising back home.
My guest is war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Chris Yanu, and he was chief of surgery for the Red Cross in Somalia from February of 92 through January of 93. And before that, he'd served for 8 years with the Palestine Red Crescent Society in Lebanon, and he has a new book called Besieged about his work from 1985 to 87 as the only surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp Shatila in West Beirut. How do you decide when it's time for you to leave a place? Why did you leave Somalia last month?
Somalia was basically because my mission had come to an end, and I had already extended a couple of times at the request of ICRC.
Mm-hmm.
After my experiences in Lebanon, and I had been through fighting in Beirut and the Israeli invasion and the fighting in the north and then back in the refugee camp, I stayed in Shatila for 27 months without leaving once, 200 yards by 200 yards. And when I got out, I needed to get out. And as I say in the book, I had to leave. I couldn't leave. I left and yet no. In some way, Shatila and I remained together. And it is the moral boundaries of Shatila that allow me to go to places like Cambodia and Somalia. And what I have learned is that if I'm going to be efficient as a surgeon and useful to my patients, that I have to pull back at a certain time, that no matter how obsessive a situation is, you come to a point where you've got to take some distance, pull back, get out, change your ideas. I usually change my ideas in New York's jazz bars. and then, after a couple of months of that, you're ready to go back again.
What's the point between basic depression, disillusionment, hunger, and exhaustion? What's the difference between that and knowing that it's really time to get out?
Well, first of all, you're not indispensable. You have to realize that. I mean, there are other people who are coming in and will replace you. No problem. You have to know. I mean, and also, I was doing a great deal of training.
Mm-hmm.
Now, teaching, as any teacher will tell you, is a very repetitive process. And that's why school holidays are so long, usually. So if I'm visiting 10 different hospitals in each place, I'm teaching the local staff how to do sterilization. Now, for them, it's the first time they've heard it. They're interested. But by the 10th time you repeat it, you're sick and tired of what you're saying. You're no longer fresh. You're getting bored with what you're doing. And that's a good time to pull back as well.
Do you ever get bored of surgery?
I don't get bored with surgery, although I do get angry and frustrated at times. I think the best example was in Shatila. And it was simply that people were so frustrated themselves that they then started doing stupid things, putting themselves at risk, or going through areas that were open to sniper fire. And because they were simply too lazy to go through a trench, where they would be protected from sniper fire, and they were a above in a exposed area, they would be shot. And another wounded patient would come back into the hospital and I would have to operate. And finally, you know, I would sit there and pull at my hair and scream and shout at people, you know. I don't really want to operate here. I mean, I've had enough blood. And if the difference between that and having somebody with a bullet in their head or not is just that they go through the trench rather than go above ground, then it can be very, very frustrating.
Now, I understand you're about to go to Geneva to get reassigned by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Do you know what's next for you?
Well, that'll be in a couple of months, and it really depends quite literally on what shit is hitting which fan. And there's a possibility of it being Angola, Sudan.
How do you feel about going to another place, having to be introduced to a new conflict, a new cast of characters, a new culture that it's happening in?
Oh, that's one of the best things about this job. Over the last 20 years that I've been running around the third world, I've been introduced to all sorts of different cultures and new people. And I've been able to see the absolute wealth of human diversity. And I think I'm very, very lucky to have that possibility.
Gitan cigarettes play an important part in your book, Besieged. You not only smoke them a lot, you hand them out a lot. And it's funny, you know, doctors are always warning us how we shouldn't smoke and so on, and every day there's new evidence about the dangers of smoking. Does that not bother you because you're so exposed to more immediate dangers?
Well, obviously, I mean, my cliche answer is when you have to dodge stray bullets, I mean, who cares about smoking at that point? You take calculated risks in a war zone. You try to avoid stupid risks. I mean, just being in a war zone is a calculated risk. So is walking in certain parts of Washington, D.C. or L.A. or New York.
Or Philadelphia.
Or Philadelphia. Crossing the street in Rome is a calculated risk. So, yes, I mean, I think the important thing, whether it's smoking, drinking, eating salt, cholesterol, etc., jogging, and so on, aerobics, that one accepts one's own mortality. We are all of us going to die one day, at least once. And I think that people have difficulty dealing with that. I mean, it's a very, very late 20th century narcissistic Western attitude that me, and I have to live, and I have to have all of this, and I have to do it, and I have to have it. And I don't want to die, but you will, one day.
And you feel like you've accepted your mortality?
So if you accept your mortality, for me, it also means that you've accepted life. People who refuse their mortality are the people who are refusing life. And I think it's a philosophical point of view. It has nothing to do with epidemiology. It has everything to do with philosophy and why one lives to begin with. Why would you want to live another 10 years if you're bored with your life?
Just quickly, does this help explain why you're always putting your life on the line?
That was not the original intent, and certainly I don't think it's continued to be that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, there are calculated risks, even in being in New York City. So that I don't think is the motivation. But, I mean, I would call myself a very existentialist type of person. And I still like to read Camus. And you really have to make your life on a day-to-day basis, and you have to make the decisions daily of why I should not commit suicide today. What reason have I given myself for living today? And you go on from there.
Dr. Yanou, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Chris Yanou has written a book about his work as a war surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp Shatila in Beirut. The book is called Besieged, and it's published by Olive Branch Press. This is Fresh Air. A little later on All Things Considered, we'll be hearing about increased fighting in Somalia. Linda Wertheimer, what's the story?
Apparently, as the day comes closer for the U.S. to hand off to the U.N., Terry, the situation is growing less and less stable. Suni Khalid will have a report, and Robert Siegel will talk to an aid worker there. We also have a report on the Secretary of Defense's health. Les Aspin is in the hospital, where there's some concern about who's running the store, and perhaps his situation is more serious than we've been told. President Clinton's sin taxes is Mar-a-Liason's subject from the White House, and we'll hear about plans to build a casino in New Orleans and concerns that it could wreck the Big Easy.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been listening to some reissues on the Verve label of jazz singers recorded in the 1950s. That got him thinking about the cool influence shaping jazz at the time, for better and for worse. This is Helen Merrill.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'll go my way by myself. Love is only a dance.
In 50s jazz, cool was king, but cool jazz took different forms. One strain came from Miles Davis and the birth of the cool sessions. Another kind of cool came from the musical theater, source of so many jazz standards. As musicals aspired to a greater integration of music and plot, songs became more deliberately speech-like, and for some artists, jazz singing became more and more like method acting. This is singer and pianist Blossom Dearie from 1958.
The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains, you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking and blinking. Ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking that I'd care to swap for that shiny little Surrey with the fringe on the top.
Miles Davis was an early supporter of Blossom Dearie's, and she is sort of a missing link between the insistently low-key Miles and the close-mouthed Marlon Brando. Some singers had even more deadpan vocal styles, like California's Julie London and New York's Helen Merrill. Merrill's 1956 album, Dream of You, just reissued on CD, had charts by Birth of the Cool arranger Gil Evans. Her inertia is different from Blossom Dearie's. Merrill sings with such ladylike decorum, she makes the melody come to her instead of rushing off to meet it. And like a real lady, she doesn't perspire.
Don't throw bouquets at me. Don't please my folks too much. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love. Don't sigh and gaze at me. Your sighs are so like mine. Your eyes mustn't glow like mine. People will say we're in love. Don't stop collecting things. Give me my rose and my glove. Sweetheart, they're suspecting things. People will say we're in love. Don't laugh at my jokes too much.
Cool was so hot back then, even Ella Fitzgerald got into it. She made the album Ella Swings Lightly with the L.A. Cool studio band, the Marty Paich Dectet. Well, she may be swinging lightly, but you always know she's swinging.
Maybe I can't give you diamonds and things like I want to, but I can promise you, baby, I'm gonna want to as long as I live. I never can. cared, but now I'm scared. I won't live long enough. That's why I wear my rubbers when it rains and eat an apple every day, then see the doctor anyway. What if I can't live to love you as long as I want to? Long as I promise you, baby, I'm gonna love you as long as I live.
Ella Fitzgerald had come up singing in ballrooms and concert halls, not theaters and supper clubs, and she had a different approach from more actorly singers. If Helen Merrill celebrated passive resistance, Ella could lift the band off its feet, even when negotiating a theater song's tiny step melody.
Ask me how do I feel, ask me now that we're fondly caressing. Pal, if I were a salad, I know I'd be splashing my dressing. Or if I were a season, I'd surely be spring. Or if I were a bell, I'd go ding, dong, ding, dong, ding.
Ella Fitzgerald is easily the most famous living jazz musician, but too few people appreciate how great her best work is. By 1957, she'd embarked on a series of recordings for the Verve label, which were amazing in their scope and depth. With her classic Gershwin, Arlen, and Berlin songbooks, she mastered the Broadway and Hollywood repertoire, but she was still singing novelties and doing concerts where her energy had more to do with rock or R&B than cool jazz. There's a live recording of Ella singing Goody Goody, where she and Oscar Peterson's combo sound closer to early Elvis than to Helen Merrill or Blossom Dearie. In the mid-50s, cool was contagious, but Ella's temperature ran a couple of degrees above normal.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator based in New York. He reviewed some new Verve reissues by Helen Merrill, Blossom Dearie, and Ella Fitzgerald.
So you lie awake just singing the blues all night. Goody, goody, you think that love's a barrel of dynamite. Hooray and hallelujah, you had it coming to ya. Goody, goody for her, goody, goody for me. And I hope you're satisfied, you ask for you.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a Grammy Award winner and an Academy Award nominee. We rebroadcast our 1989 interview with Eric Clapton, who swept the Grammys. And we feature our interview with Michael Tolkin about his screenplay for The Player, which is nominated for an Oscar. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.